Everyone hits a bump in the road. What do you do with it? Be inspired as we explore the ways people experience, navigate, and manage the ups and downs and twists and turns in this road trip called life. This is the second part of my conversation with Doug Stoddard. We explore a number of topics relating to our habits of thinking and how we can create our reality. We look at forgiveness, shame, empathy, and other emotions that influence how we perceive our world. Doug, so during the first part of our podcast, you had a quote that I really liked. You said, "I recognize that I was the issue." Excuse me. And I think realizing that we are the issue in terms of creating our reality and our problems is such an intriguing topic.
Boy, it really is, Pat. And I think it's one of the most challenging things to wrap our heads around, you know? Our tendency, and it was for me, is when we go through challenging times and we seem like we're just keep hitting that same wall over and over again, we start to look at it's external things that are the problem. Well, it's because my boss laid me off, or it's because I got this health problem, or it's because we lost money. For myself, I went through bankruptcy. And so it's very, very easy to blame everything else instead of looking at yourself. And so that's where I was. I was the one. The answers were really there. But I wasn't open to receiving them. And it was because of my habits of thinking that kept me stuck in trying to figure out all the solutions myself. I may have shared this with you, but my mentor at one point owed $1 million. He was trying to pay it off. And in the process of all this, he went through suicidal tendencies, just all kinds of issues. And when it came down to it, where he finally paid off the last $14,000 check and it was free, and he says, you know, I dropped to my knees in gratitude that finally this problem was over with. And he said, a voice came to him and says, "Well, Dave, what did you learn through all of this?" And he says, and this is where it answers your question, and it's very true for me. And he says, "Well, I've learned that you open the doors and I do the work. When I try to force the doors to open, it's very frustrating. It does not work. And when I expect you to do the work for me, that doesn't work either. So you open the doors, the opportunities, and I step into it and do the work." And so for me, that was part of this process. To answer your question, Pat, is we get in the way when we try to force doors to open in our lives, and when we expect other people to do the work for us.
Yeah, and often, go ahead.
Well, oftentimes that we get into the victim mindset, and that really creates a block of us moving forward. So anyway, that's what I've learned in this journey. Quit trying to force the doors and quit expecting some angel from heaven to come down and just give it to you.
Those are hard lessons, though, because we want to have control of our lives. And yet, do we?
Well, the more we try to control things, the less control we have. And I mentioned this before, but I'm really on a journey of surrendering. And what does that mean in my life? And part of it is just recognizing I don't have to have all the answers, and I don't have to be tied into all the outcomes, and that I can just, if we'll just quit trying to force life to happen for us and just sit back and allow allow the doors to open for us, but take action one little step at a time, then life is so much easier. So much easier.
It is. And it's a lesson that I struggle with. I had a hip replacement recently, and part of the PT was exercising every day. And that's not been fun. But and I like to work out and everything. But I mean, this was getting a little tedious. However, I can now look back 3 months out, and that those little repetitive movements that I did every day have really yielded results. You know, results in terms of strength and muscle mass and everything else. And it's such a lesson for me to remember that these baby steps really pay off, but you have to have patience.
Oh, that, boy, that's a word you could talk for hours on, right?
Oh, patience. I'm on this earth to learn patience, and I'm presented with repeated opportunities.
Well, when it comes to people who are entrepreneurial minded or leaders, patience is not an attribute. Many times we want to get things done. If a hip replacement is slowing us down, it's a nuisance. But I heard something today that was really profound. He says, usually the answers to what we need are in the things we don't want to do. So just go do them.
Oh, that's interesting.
I'm a habit breaker expert. And that's something I really work with people on. I'm working on myself is when you recognize the feeling not to do something, I don't want to do that. I don't want to go run today. I don't want to exercise. I don't want to, whatever it may be, then that's exactly what you should be doing. There's your key right there.
Well, I know for me, that's marketing. I don't like the marketing side of things. So I've created Marketing Monday. So first thing in the week, I have to do that before I can do anything else.
I love that. See, you created a system, Pat, right?
Yeah.
And if we will simply learn how to create a little system to support what we don't want to do and break it down to a small enough piece, we can go through life not living in so much resistance.
And I think that if we can be in the moment, which takes practice, this goes along with what you're saying, things flow in the moment. Things don't flow when you're in your head.
Oh, I love that. Flow in the moment, but not in your head, right?
Yeah, when you're in your head, you're not present. You're not living this moment, and you're creating whatever false narrative that you're creating, because whatever you create probably won't happen. So you're living a false narrative without being there.
Yes, and you're absolutely right. We call it hamster wheeling.
Monkey mind. That's what the Buddhists call it.
Monkey mind, yeah. It's very true, and it's a place where I spent a lot of my time in the past.
How did you learn to recognize your thoughts?
Oh, boy, that's really good, because I believe until we become aware of them, nothing changes. At least on a permanent basis or more sustained basis. So it's a process, and it's a process I help people with as well. But because we're so close to ourselves, right, Pat? I mean, we're right here. We're so used to the thoughts that we have, we can't hear them. So part of the process sometimes is you need to have somebody else hear what you're saying. And share that with you.
Oh, I think that's very true. And I think if they can honestly share what they're hearing, it can be a real kick in the butt.
Yeah, I was talking just with my wife the other day, and I've been doing what I do for almost 10 years. But the other day I recognized something that I did that oh, there I go again. I'm needing to be right. And that it was at a deeper level than before. I had a lady yesterday, we were talking, and she was so excited on one side, but not on the other side. And she was excited because she had told me when we first started working together that she said, oh, I don't need to be right. And then 3 months later, she says, oh, my goodness, this whole week I've become aware of just how often I need to be right about my opinions and thoughts and what we should be doing. And she said, I don't like it, but it's really good to become aware of it. So first of all, it's really important that you have somebody there to help hear what you're hearing. But it also takes reflection. If you're getting triggered, where you have an emotional response and you become reactive to it, those are moments that if you'll take the time to reflect on it and ask yourself questions, and this is what I do. I said, what is it that I'm feeling right now? And why am I feeling it? What did somebody else do or say that triggered this? And where did I go with it? So that's part of the awareness process, is recognizing when you're triggered and then step back and be able to evaluate it.
I think the desire to be right also goes to being judgmental.
Why do you say that? I'm just curious.
Because I'm right. Well, no, because you're trying to enforce your view of the world on a situation or a person. And who are you to do that?
Do you know what? Well, that's a great question. But do you know what drives that, Pat?
Your ego, I would think. Yeah, or your insecurity. Your insecurity.
Yeah, you're hitting around it, and it's for me. We have this tool that will measure people's neural pathways and their habits of thinking, and one of the measurements that it tells us if you're hyper analytical, you know, in your head, mm-hmm. overthinking. And so we can take that, and then we look over into their self-worth. And we look at what kind of talk is going on there. And what the brain actually does is it's very easy for it to create an expectation. You overthink something, you over-visualize something, and it creates an expectation, and your brain can't tell the difference between the two, what's real and what isn't. And so when somebody challenges that, and if you have self-talk going on, then the brain will attach your idea to your self-worth. And that's where the need to be right comes from, is if your brain is trying to protect you. And it's either trying to do it by protecting your very worth as a human being. That's what it can feel like people are challenging when they don't like your idea, don't agree with you, or it can be related to, it feels like they're challenging your very character, your very worth, or it can feel like they're challenging your skill sets. And that's what we fight against. And sometimes we verbalize it and we can create an argument, but a lot of people today are suppressing it. And when you suppress expressing yourself, that doesn't work either. That just creates resentment. But anyway, those are some of the things I learned, because I was the king of needing to be right. And it was all attached to when I went through bankruptcy. And my self-worth was in the tank. And so I always needed to be right to prove that I had worth.
So, how did you learn to forgive yourself?
Oh, wow. That's a pretty tender topic. Because when we have things like bankruptcy or those kinds of things, if there's been abuse or different things, it's very easy to carry shame. And when we have shame, then we want to hide something that we don't want other people to know about us. And so then we begin to live in two different worlds, not sure which persons we should show up as. And that created a real issue with me. So I recognize I had a great mentor to help me unload my bag, you know, where the bankruptcy was. And he helped me to understand that we do have to find the value, the lesson in our life experiences. And then he taught me how to make it my best friend. I now look at my bankruptcy as one of my best friends.
What are the good things that came out of it for you?
I was humbled. That's one thing. The second thing is I have a lot more empathy for people who have gone through financial problems. That's not fun when the creditors are calling you. That's a rotten place to be, personally. The other lessons from that is I learned to quit trying to force outcomes. And I'm still working on that one. That's part of surrender. But what I learned, Pat, is when I was finally able to take it out of my bag of life, find the value in it, forgive the people that were associated with the bankruptcy, because I had a lot of anger towards some people related to that. And when I came to grips with, I couldn't change it. There are wonderful lessons here. It certainly helped me to move forward, so I've never been in that place again. We're very careful with our money, you know, whereas before we weren't. And when I got to that place then, what I found is I was then free to be vulnerable about telling people that I had been through bankruptcy. And up to that point, I would never, ever tell anybody that I've been through bankruptcy. Never.
I think the empathy that comes out of the bumps in the road of life, if you will, is very, very beneficial for us and for people around us. And unfortunately, I don't think we can develop that empathy without going through those hardships.
I agree. How else would you get it?
You know, I think you can listen to people, you can, you know, try to understand where they are, but until you've had a similar experience, you just don't get it.
Yeah. I certainly have much more tender empathy towards people.
You know, one of the things that you brought up that I think is really important is you talked about how important it is to listen well.
Yeah, and that goes back to where I didn't have a relationship with, especially my daughter. And what I've learned in that process is that so often, well, first of all, that where did I learn how to communicate or listen from? Who did I learn that from? Well, we learn it from our parents, and they learned it from their parents. And so consequently, no one really teaches us how to really listen. And so what I've learned through this is that, first of all, I learned what I was doing that wasn't listening. And that one of those things that I'm preoccupied in my mind with, well, what am I going to say next? Yeah. Or the other one would be, being preoccupied with my own personal problems, that will totally block you in your ability to connect with someone at a deep level. other ones that get in the way is when we have agenda-itis inside of us. We're in a conversation, but we have an agenda. For me, it was to fix my daughter. You know, she was the problem. Or if you're in sales of any kind, it was, I need to sell you my car or whatever it may be. We all have agendas. And when we are focused on the agenda, then we're not focused on the individual. And they will feel it.
You are so right about that. If you can find a way in business, particularly, to come from a place, to come from your heart, when you're trying to, I'll say sell something, but if you're coming from your heart, you're not selling it. You're presenting the opportunity. You're talking about how this can be beneficial, and if that's real, people feel it.
Yeah, and the opposite's true. They feel it when it's not real, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, and that's because we have mirror neurons inside our head. I call them environmental detectors, and they pick up on everything someone else is doing and then feeds it very quickly into our subconscious, and we begin to feel things about people long before they say anything.
Well, you know, and it's interesting. I was thinking this just the other day, that exposure to people and their energy is fascinating. When you meet somebody in person versus, say, on Zoom, you get very different reads, don't you?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's true. That's true. Why do you say that, though? What's been
I'm going off on a tangent here. No, I say it because, well, we were both at a meeting recently. And
yes.
At that meeting, I interviewed a number of people for the podcast, and it was, in some cases, the first time I met them in person. And it was very interesting because in person, let me back up. I think that sometimes our online communications create quick intimacy because it's just you and me, and we can't see enough of each other to form these judgments that we all form. And then when you're in person, you're distracted. You're seeing something, the physicality of them, their facial expressions in three dimensions. It's a very different experience, I found. And I've found myself just mulling that over a bit the last few days.
Does it feel more real when it's in person?
What scares me is it may be more real online in some ways. And maybe that's just a result of, you know, relativize the isolation a lot of us have experienced in the last few years, because in person, there are so many more elements to take into consideration. You may be in a crowded room. It may be noisy. There are distractions. It's just a very different experience. At least it was for me.
Well, isn't that interesting? Because as you're talking, what comes to mind is questions I like to ask people that causes some really deep reflection, and that is, how do people experience me when I am with them? And the second question that is to that is, how do they experience themselves when I am with them?
Oh, that's interesting.
See, most of us don't go to that level. But what do we do and say that either gives them a very positive experience or a negative experience? You know, what do people say about me when I leave the room?
That's a terrifying idea, isn't it?
Well, you asked, how do we listen? How do we communicate with people? And how did you learn to listen? Well, it's asking those kinds of questions, because recently at the meeting that you and I were at, I was listening to a woman that was just talking nonstop. And she was talking to a woman that was next to both of us. And I'm feeling uncomfortable. I used to talk a lot. Now I've learned to listen more and ask questions before I talk. And finally, this lady the one that was listening, she finally interrupted this other person and told her, "You have got to slow down. Your energy is way too fast and too much for me. You're losing me." And so that comes back to this question that we can all ask ourselves is, how do people experience me when I'm with them? And how do they experience themselves? What kind of emotions and feelings are they having?
I think how we experience ourselves is a very interesting perspective, because I think different people bring out different aspects of ourselves.
Oh, that's a great point. Have you had an experience with that yourself?
Oh, I'm sure I have. And let me think. I can think particularly when I was younger, I was always trying to please people. I mean, always trying to please people. I don't think I do that as much anymore, but there's still a piece of me that certainly wants to be liked or accepted or respected. I think that's there. So I think that depending on who we're with, we may, I don't know, I'll say I sometimes adjust myself a bit. For example, if I'm somebody with somebody who talks a lot, like this woman you mentioned, I tend to just be quiet. I trying to interrupt them or get them to recognize that they're just blasting mindless energy out there. It's not worth it. You can't convince them. So I'm quiet and I listen and I look and I just learn. And I know for a fact they're not interested in me because they haven't even taken 2 seconds to ask a question.
Yeah. So how do you experience them? You just
I tune out.
Yeah. See.
Now, if I were with somebody who asks questions like you are, I'm very engaged.
Yeah. And it's real simple, right? It's not rocket science. If you want to connect with people, then ask questions, step into their world. There's an interesting study done, Pat, at the University, I think it's University of Tennessee, in which they took the best of relationships, you know, a husband, wife, been together quite a few years, and they were trying to identify how much cooperation we hold back with, you know, how much of ourselves do we hold back, even in the best of relationships. And they found that we, even in the best of relationships, we withhold 40% until we feel valued, heard, and understood and safe. And I ask a question of people often as I speak and coach in different things. When was the last time you had a conversation in which you felt truly safe, heard, and valued, so that you just felt you could bring your walls down and just be open and share? And, you know, I've been asking that question probably 8 or 9 years, and there's probably only been about 6 who could remember having that type of an experience. And they could tell me exactly where they were and who it was with.
And that's interesting. Yeah. I would say I have 2 friends, one in particular, who I have that type of conversation with when almost every time we talk, not every single time, but there's a degree of openness and trust in the relationship that is really phenomenal. But it's very, and it's partly because I think she's a very evolved person. We're both pretty honest about things. But that's a pretty rare situation.
Yeah, you said you had probably 2 friends that you can do that with.
Yeah, one I'm a little closer to than the other, but they're both great people.
Yeah, it's because you're a safe place.
You know, I think as you go on and you make mistakes in life, you realize that you don't have any particular corner on the truth. Everybody's truth is a little bit different. And I think there's a lot more to be gained by trying to listen and understand than impose your will, because, you know, there may be no right or wrong in a situation.
It's just our perspective then.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. Which is, And that can vary too, from one year to the next. And that is so true. But you know, one of my greatest joys now, after going through bankruptcy, lost relationship, now business is doing great. Relationships are thriving, not perfect, but thriving. And I just found that in this whole process, because I can hear what's important to people, and I want to engage and learn more about that, that's what's brought the most joy, I think. And it's not only being able to hear people, it's being able to hear me. And that's refreshing, when you can actually hear yourself and step back from it. I love the concept of relationships and how to create safe places where people feel not only safe and valued and heard, but they feel empowered after you have the conversation.
Wow, and to leave people empowered is an amazing goal, and to actually do that is incredible.
Well, it helps me to feel more whole inside. Have you noticed when you walk away from the conversations with those two friends that you feel more whole, more peaceful?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, so, but once again, I think the challenge that a lot of people have, Pat, is they go through life and they don't take the time to invest in themselves.
And I would add, they don't take the time to learn to love themselves, which is, I think, difficult for a lot of us.
You're right. You're right. But they don't know how to do it.
And that goes back to what you were saying about thought patterns that we inherit, that are sort of intergenerational inheritances, if you will. So much of our makeup is an intergenerational inheritance, where our grandparents did it this way, our parents did it this way, we were taught to do it this way. It takes a lot to break those sorts of habits.
Oh, it does, because they're very ingrained. It's not an overnight shift or that
and
way.
Just to recognize them.
Yeah. Like I said, until you recognize them and become aware of them, there's no chance, in my opinion, that you're able to move forward and break the cycle. So awareness is always the first step. And to me, then the next step related to it is to break it down into very small steps of what you're going to do. And then the third thing is the process of celebrating the little things. I have really fallen in love with celebrating Doug. And that may sound a little arrogant, but I've been on the far side of that, where there was no celebration of Doug. There was no winning for me. I was a perfectionist. I had all this self-dialogue going on, and it was very foreign to me to say, "Hey, Doug, way to go. I'm proud of you." But now I do it about anywhere from 6 to 10, 12 times a day. And it's little crazy things, Pat. It's little things like, instead of walking past the paper on the floor, I stop and pick it up. And then I say, "Way to go, Dougie. I'm proud of you for doing this." And anyway, that's...
No, I think that's actually really important. I know now that I'm coming out of this recovery period a bit from this hip, which did not go as smoothly as it was supposed to. I'm finally feel like I'm climbing out of this hole and getting things, Now, this is going to go towards perfectionism, but it's not. It's self-love. But getting things right again, getting them a little organized. And when I do, I feel like there's a part of me that's just joyous because I'm doing it for myself. And it's really a gift to me. And I think it's those little things, whether it's getting the pantry organized, getting your closet organized, or having a place be aesthetically pleasing. Those things matter.
And why do they matter to you?
They
what
matter
does it mean for you.
They make me happy. They please me. They're creative sometimes. I like that. That pleases me. Visual. I'm very visual. So when I make something visually more pleasing to me, that is something I enjoy. I think those are the key pieces. And I think I've moved to a new town and I'm really enjoying where I'm living more than I've enjoyed any place my whole life. And there's a lot of daily joy in that. I was at a photography club meeting the other night. It wasn't the best meeting, but I was so happy to be there and grateful to take the step to go. There's a talk next week about the Powder Puff Derby, which was a women's pilots cross-country race in 1929 that has just fascinating stories associated with it. And I'm so looking forward to that. So those are things that are certainly I'm doing just for me. They're out of self-love because they reflect my interests and things that are near and dear to me. And I think that it's important to have those things in your life.
Well, it certainly makes life come alive, right? I think often, I love what you're saying there, because what you're doing is you're finding joy now. And as I work with a lot of people who are in the hunt for success, many of them are waiting for something to happen. Then they'll be happy. Then they'll find fulfillment. Then, and it's always something down the road. And what you're finding is you're finding joy now. And part of it sounds like has come from because of what you went through with your hip replacement. And
well, I'm testing the opposite theory. I'm testing the theory that if you do what you enjoy and it brings you joy, that success can come out of it.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. I was in that state. I was in that state of, well, when I finally get my business growing again, then I can be happy. But finding joy in the moment where you are, oh, that's so good.
A combination of cancer and a meditation practice really drove that home for me. With cancer, I realized how tentative life can be and how incredibly important and meaningful the present moment is, whatever that has for you. And meditating has allowed me to still my mind, be more present. It's provided that quiet place so that I can actually observe my thoughts. And that's a game changer.
Yes, and I'm grateful you said that, because most of us have very active minds. And until you can get to a place where you can still your mind, you know, quiet it down, you can't hear yourself. That's what you're saying, Pat?
You can't hear yourself. And also, you're unconscious of the script that's going through your mind that you're acting out. You're absolutely unconscious.
Yeah. Yeah, that's so true.
And I think once you open that door, it continues to open to allow you to, as you were saying, observe how you react in a situation with somebody. Observe how they react to you. You can't really do those things until you can find a place of stillness.
Yes. And we are so busy and distracted in the world that it's hard for people to get. And so a question comes to mind. Is it uncomfortable, you think, for some people to become still?
Yes. Absolutely. I was talking to somebody not too long ago, and she was with the topic of meditation came up, and she said, "Oh, your mind's never still." And I said, my mind goes totally still. Now, that's a practice, and is it perfect every time? No, it is not. It's something you have to practice, and I'll say work at, but it's not that you work at it. It's just that you cultivate that muscle, if you will. And I found her comments just interesting, because she's very into health and yoga and all these things, but her mind is just continually racing, I realized.
Yeah. I love still minds.
Yeah, me too, and I like quiet. With my recent change of routine with all this physical therapy, I broke it down into two sessions. So I changed my meditation practice from one long one in the morning to two 20-minute meditations. And the change in routine was really good for me, because I learned to meditate with a gentleman who studied actually with the Maharishi. And, you know, I went into I took a course on transcendental meditation, where you meditate twice a day, 20 minutes. And I hadn't done that for a while. My meditations had been getting longer and longer, and once a day. I found it really refreshing and interesting to go back to that 20-minute twice a day routine. There's a reason they tell you to do that. It's really valuable.
Yeah, because when I think about it, mine's usually in the morning. And yeah, and the rest of the day, my brain's just rolling.
So tell people a little bit about your business and how they can reach you.
Yeah, like I said, thank you. Thank you very much for the opportunity to be with you. I have really enjoyed it. But I'm a habit breaker expert for businesses. My purpose is to strengthen families. And as one client told me after coaching 16 of their management, he says, "You know, Doug, the greatest value you bring to our company, there are many of them, but the greatest value is how our people now show up at home. And then home is a better place. And when they come back, they bring a better version of themselves into the workplace." And so my purpose is to help. And what I do is to help people quickly identify their habits of thinking that are stored in their neural pathways that are that's what gets triggered. And when those are triggered, then we get the emotions and we get the self-talk and the distortion of who we are and who other people are, and distortion of situations. And so I help people to quickly identify that. And then I help them to create new neural pathways so they have better emotions, they have better awareness, better clarity, and to be able to create more sustained happiness, purpose, confidence, and results in their life. And so I do that, and they can get more information by going to my website. It's just DougStoddard.com. And if they like, I have a tool that will bring this awareness to them. It's just online, 15 minutes. It'll tell exactly what their neural pathways are and what the habits of thinking are that are stored in there. And I'll walk through it with people and give them some insights and clarity. So that's what I offer with people, and I do it with companies and individuals and small businesses. But it's all to strengthen families.
Want to hear more of the conversation? Sign up at bumpintheroad.us as a Bump 2 subscriber. Buy us a cup of coffee. You can give it a go for free. Just use the code FREEMONTH. And thank you for listening today. I hope you found something in today's podcast that inspires you along your own life's path, because sometimes a bump in the road is actually a portal into a more conscious and meaningful life.